My name is Remy Hernandez. I'm with the Las Vegas Lawyers Chapter, and I went to UNLV School of Law, and every time I tell people I'm from Las Vegas, they say, "You guys really have a law school there?" And I go, "Yes." And the next question they ask is, "Do you guys have a casino in the law school?" The answer is no. But the name of the law school is the William S. Boyd School of Law, and anybody who's been to Las Vegas knows how much of an influence Boyd Gaming has in Las Vegas, so it's easy for people to think that in Las Vegas, all educational institutions have casinos in them. But education is a very important topic near and dear to my heart, as it was to President Reagan. He once stated to the Catholic Teachers Association on April 15th, 1981, that excellence demands competition among students and among schools, and why not? We must always meet our obligation to those who would fall behind without our assistance. But let's remember, without a race, there can be no champion, no records broken, no excellence in education or any other walk of life. This freedom to choose what type of education is best for each child has contributed much to America's reputation for excellence in education. Unfortunately, the high plane of literacy and the diversity of education we have achieved is threatened by policymakers who seem to prefer uniform mediocrity to the rich variety that has been our heritage. And I hope none of the speakers were planning to quote from that section. It is my pleasure to introduce the moderator from this panel, which is Justice Clint Bolick. Justice Clint Bolick was appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court in 2016, and in 2018 was retained to the voters for a six-year term. Prior to joining the court, Justice Bolick litigated constitutional cases in state and federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. And among other positions, he served as Vice President for Litigation at the Goldwater Institute and co-founder and Vice President for Litigation in the Institute of Justice. He graduated from the University of California, Davis with his law degree and a Bachelor of Arts degree from Drew University, and he's written a dozen books, and among his most recent books are Immigration Wars, Forging an American Solution, co-authored with former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and David Hammer's The Case for an Activist Judiciary. So without any further ado, I present to you Justice Clint Bolick. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for all being here, and thanks so much to the Federalist Society for putting together this wonderful forum. It's great to be back to my legal roots in California, although I have to say, being from UC Davis and having acquired, shall we say, a taste for wine, I like the ones in Napa better. There is something very, very special about renewing our values in this incredible place is the repository of so much of the incredible spirit of Ronald Reagan. I'm delighted to be joined by my co-panelists today. To my immediate right is Kara Fitzpatrick, who is an editor of Chalkbeat, as she said. It's not typical to have an education journalist at a Federalist Society conference, her biography in your materials is overly modest. She recently wrote a book that is getting a tremendous amount of coverage called The Death of Public School, How Conservatives Won the War Over Education in America. And you can trust that we'll be talking about that. To Kara's right is Tim Keller. Tim is Vice President and Legal Director at the Center for Rights of Abused Children in Phoenix, or I should say in Arizona. Yes. I don't know whether it's in Phoenix or not. More importantly, Tim was the very, very first lawyer that I hired when I moved to Phoenix, Arizona to open the Arizona chapter of the Institute for Justice, and we litigated school choice cases together along with some other really, really cool cases as well, and I am so glad that he remains very, very active in this fight. And to his right is Aaron Valdez, who is the policy director for Next Generation Texas, which is a program of the Texas Public Policy Foundation that pushes for education reform. So I would begin by just briefly saying that these are the best of times and the worst of times for education in America. It's the best of times because the realm of the possible in education policy has never been broader than it is today. When we think back to the fact that 21 years ago, the prospect of having school choice at all that included private schools came down to one vote on the United States Supreme Court in the Zelman decision. If that case had come out differently, our conversation would be far, far more constrained. But it's the worst of times because America's K-12 education system is one of the worst in the entire industrialized world. And the situation grew worse during COVID, and the academic gap between low-income and minority children on the one hand and other children has grown wider than ever. Over 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education issued the solemn promise of equal educational opportunities for all American school children, we are getting our clocks cleaned by our competitors. And number one in the world is China. And we cannot afford for that gap to continue. So we've got to make this issue a priority, both for lawyers and for policymakers, and to make good on the promise of Brown versus Board of Education. So I had not mentioned this. We had talked right beforehand that we were actually going to start with opening statements and then plunge into some questions that I have, followed by questions from you all following that. But I hadn't mentioned to Kara that we were going to do that. So I will ask Aaron to start and do openings in that order.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I think the theme that I want to emphasize today is parent empowerment. And it really kind of goes back to something that President Reagan said in 1989. He said, when we're talking about school choice, we're talking about reasserting the right of American parents to play a vital, perhaps the central part in designing the kind of education they believe their children need. And so he made that comment on January 10th, 1989. But my story goes back a few years before that. I'd like to start with some audience participation. I'm going to read you a quote, and then I'm going to ask you to vote on it. Here's the quote. If a person is illiterate or only speaks Spanish, how are they possibly going to teach their kids to read and write English? Raise your hand if you think a Republican said that. Good. You're smarter than that. It's really an IQ test for the audience. The answer is that this comment was made by Representative Mike Friedman, a Democrat from Miami in 1985, to the Lakeland Ledger. And the reason I know about this comment because my parents saved a bunch of newspaper clippings from the time. Why did they do that? Because in 1984, they decided to homeschool me and my sisters, and it wasn't really legal in Florida. My parents are an HVAC tradesman and a homemaker. They did not go to college, and we grew up in trailer parks, single wides and double wides. The story of my family is the story of school choice, in the sense that it started out with parents first being dissatisfied with the choices in front of them. And part of the panel today is about trust in education. Well, back in 1984, my parents did not trust the public education system or the schools in Central Florida. And so even though there weren't any choices at the time, they found them anyway. And they were smart enough to sift through the choices in front of them. They had to do a lot of research to figure that out. They had to write away to various entities, including the HSLDA, right? And they made a choice that was courageous because it wasn't just legally dubious, it was socially dubious, right? My parents' parents were very, very skeptical. And my father's mother, my grandmother, was a school teacher, And she flatly asserted that she didn't think we were going to learn to read or write, which wasn't true, obviously. We're here today. But it was a lot of pressure. And so I guess the thesis I want to drive home is that this has always been about parental rights and parental empowerment. And up until recently, I think the fight has been on fairly abstract grounds about choice. And where we're seeing progress in Texas is because we've moved the conversation back to where it belongs, which is with parent empowerment. And I'm happy to talk more about that later when we move to the Texas conversation. Thank you.
All right. Well, my goal is to quickly introduce you to the concept of the Education Savings Account Program, which is one of the most popular, fastest growing forms of educational choice in the nation. And I want to do that by just explaining how Arizona, which was the first state in the nation to adopt an ESA program, got there. What happened was that in 2006, Arizona adopted two small voucher programs. Parents were given a small scholarship to take their children to the private school of their choice. The teachers' unions quickly filed a lawsuit challenging those two voucher programs. One was for children who had special needs. The other was for children who were in foster care. $2.5 million appropriation for each, so we're talking about a rounding error in the overall state budget. Ultimately, the Arizona Supreme Court, looking at a provision of the Arizona Constitution that reads, "No tax shall be laid or appropriation of public money made in aid of any private or sectarian school." And the court said the voucher programs violated that provision of the Arizona Constitution because when parents received their voucher, they had no choice but to use it at a private or sectarian school. Now, there were two silver linings from that decision. One was that the court reaffirmed its earlier decision from 1999, a case that our esteemed moderator, Mr. Bullock, litigated in Arizona, reaffirmed that tax credit scholarships were still constitutional. They didn't constitute either a laying of a tax or an appropriation of public funds. And the court said, second, that there may well indeed be ways of helping these student populations. So we passed a tax credit program. We tried to raise money, but this was right in the middle of the Great Recession. And we weren't able to raise $5 million to help all of the students who had lost their scholarships. So we went back to the drawing board. We were scratching our heads, what are we gonna do? And I remembered a colloquy that took place between Justice Andrew Hurwitz of the Arizona Supreme Court and the teachers' union's lawyers, a gentleman I actually hold great respect for, named Don Peters. And Justice Hurwitz said, "Mr. Peters, what if instead of giving them a voucher for a private school, we just gave parents a sum of money and said, use it for education however you want? Would that violate this provision of the Arizona Constitution?" And Mr. Peters said, "No, it wouldn't, because parents' choices would not be constrained. Presumably they could use it for a tutor or some other form of education for their kids." And that became the genesis of the idea for Arizona's Education Savings Account Program. Under the program, parents are given 90% of what their student would receive if they were in a public school, and they can use it for virtually anything they want education related. The legislature does provide some restrictions, and there's tremendous oversight in the program. I'm now an ESA parent. The program is now expanded to universal. But the program itself was also challenged in court, quickly, by the teachers' unions. And ultimately what the court said was that this program was constitutional because not $1 of the program was predestined for a private school. Parents had free choice to use it for however they want. They can homeschool their child, they can send them to a private school, they can do some hybrid education, they can even use the money to purchase courses like my youngest son does at a local public school. So ultimately was upheld, and again, this is now, the Arizona program has now expanded to every single student in Arizona is eligible to participate in the program. And it's like by far the fastest and most exciting form of school choice in the country today. So I just wanted to set those terms of the debate, let you know how we got to where we are, let you know what an ESA is and what an Education Savings Account Program is. If folks have more questions about how the program operates, happy to talk about that as we engage further in this discussion.
Well, I'll just go quickly. So I've been writing about education for about 20 years, and I was a journalist in Florida for 10 of those, and that's where I was introduced to school choice. I grew up in Washington State, which has very, very little choice. I think we have 16 charter schools. And so as a reporter in Florida, I spent about 5 years writing about school segregation, particularly in one county, and very much focused on the 5 lowest performing traditional public schools in the state of Florida. And those schools were segregated by race and income, and just had devastating conditions, very high teacher turnover. I interviewed a child who had 12 teachers in 3 months. There were teachers who walked out in the middle of the day and quit. You know, just devastating conditions. And so school choice wasn't necessarily a part of that series of stories that I and a few other reporters produced. But one of the themes that came up, because we were doing this work in Florida, was that when we interviewed families, many of them were trying to flee these schools. And so some of them would go to other traditional public schools if they could. Some went to charter schools, some went to magnet schools. And then because it is Florida, some used tax credit scholarships to go to private schools. At that time, they didn't have an ESA. And this was just kind of in the back of my mind as an interesting thing, because some of these families found better options, and some didn't, and they continued kind of bouncing around. And I was interested in sort of where did school choice come from? What is this bigger history of it? I knew a little bit, you know, the Florida story and Jeb Bush's role in it, but I didn't know sort of the Milton Friedman and the longer version. And so I was interested in that, and I was interested in whether or not choice was a solution to these issues I've written about in public education, whether or not it was a systemic solution, or if it was something that was more for an individual family. And that's kind of what got started and turned into a book 5, 6 years and one pandemic later.
Awesome, thank you. A quick commentary on 2 things that Aaron and Tim said respectively. When I started my legal career at Mountain States Legal Foundation in Denver a long time ago, Aaron mentioned 1984, homeschoolers were still going to jail in a number of states. And my first work was providing pro bono counsel to Colorado families who were literally risking jail to educate their kids at home. And that really underscores how much things have changed now, where in many states, homeschoolers can avail themselves of public school resources. There are micro schools now that allow groups of families to combine their resources so that the parents don't have to do the teaching, education savings accounts, and so forth. So the world has really changed pretty dramatically. One thing I wanted to comment on that Tim mentioned, it is interesting that the genesis of education savings accounts came out of a losing lawsuit. And basically getting an idea from a liberal justice of the Arizona Supreme Court that turned out to be, in my opinion, far superior educational policy as compared with school vouchers. And Justice Hurwitz is now, many of you know this, Judge Hurwitz on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. If you happen to see him sometime, I'm sure he would be delighted to hear your thanks that he came up with the idea for education savings. With that, I'll start with Tim on this one. Could each of you briefly define public education? I think we all use that terminology, and we all assume we use a common definition. I don't know whether that's true.
Yeah, when you say define public education, there's 2 words that, well, 3 technically. Publicly funded and pluralistic. I view public education as a system not only made up of traditional government-funded schools, but that would include a myriad of other options for parents to choose from, both in the public and private sector. So charter schools, magnet schools, like you said, but also the micro schools, many of which are all of which are private in nature, traditional private schools, homeschooling, All of those can fall under the umbrella and the rubric of public education. I think our friend Corey DeAngelis has sort of one of the best taglines, fund students, not systems. So I think it's a student-centric, parent-directed system of education.
Thank you. Kara, you, what's your working definition of public education?
Well, so I think the traditional definition has been that it's publicly funded, secular, and tuition-free, and open to everyone in theory. You know, there's always been special admission schools. I think that's the traditional definition that we've had for more than 100 years. What I argue in the book is that conservatives have successfully pushed it to be what Tim just said.
Aaron.
What comes to mind when I think of public education is sort of the common school system that was created in the 1800s. This was highly geographically constrained. It's democratically influenced, i.e. by school boards. So in the back of my mind, of course, I think about public schools. To your point, I think it's expanded beyond that. I think it is important to make a distinction between education and school. So a public school might be one that is sort of directly an institutional framework created directly by, say, elected bodies. But I think it's got a broader definition now.
Very, very helpful. So Kara, you mentioned that one of your motivations in your journalism was to see what the effect of school choice in Florida, along with Arizona, has been a pioneer in school choice. What do you believe that the impact of school choice has been and will be on public education?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that was interesting for me in this research is that when this started, there was no sort of data, no research to say where this was going and if it was going to be effective. I think people, you know, advocates for it, believe that it would be something that would help public education and offer families choices outside of that. So I think one of the things that's interesting now is we have about 30 years of research, still not maybe as much as we might like, but about 30 years worth. And so there's a fairly good body of research now that says that competition does help public schools improve. You know, and there's different ways of talking about that, but that's the general idea, that competition has, in fact, helped a lot of public schools improve. And so I think that in itself is a fairly interesting piece of it. But that was research done on fairly small, targeted programs. And I think one of the questions for me going forward is, what is the effect of universal programs? You know, what will the research tell us about that? And then I think also just one of the big questions that is a little bit unanswered that people are fighting about right now is just with limited resources, you know, what's the impact financially for school districts?
Excellent. Aaron, what do you think the impact of school choice has been and will be on public education?
I would echo Kara's comments that the research on the programs that exist is generally positive for public education. And, you know, anecdotally, you hear from school districts that are located near, say, charter schools, good charter schools in Texas, that do start introducing more programs and differentiated programs for students. So at least at the local level, you can certainly see some impact from just having additional choices in a particular area.
Tim.
Well, I'll first echo the fact that the research that we have is very positive. If folks want to see a summary of that research, I see my friend Leslie Heiner in the audience at EdChoice. Their website is a great place to go and find. It's like a one-stop shop for all of the terrific research that supports the value of education choice. So you might want to check out their website. But I really, when I think about the impact on public schools, what I think of is the tremendous promise that universal programs hope or hold for public education, especially if traditional public schools and others can embrace the promise of school choice. One of the things that I was always a little frustrated about in the early days of the school choice moment, especially with the small voucher programs, was that it didn't really attract new entrants into the marketplace. There wasn't an incentive on the supply side of things. And what I've been observing in Arizona with the Universal program is the tremendous new entrance into the marketplace. New tutors, new forms of education, new opportunities for parents to design an education for their child that really works for that individual student. And that is really exciting. And like I said, because the Arizona program pulls in the traditional public schools, there's a real opportunity for them to engage in what I like call course choice. You can offer individual courses with popular teachers to students outside of the district as well. So there's a real opportunity there, not only to increase educational options for parents, but I think the other impact I've seen on public education writ large, as I defined it, is increased parental satisfaction, increased student satisfaction in the actual education that they're receiving. So that's really exciting and holds tremendous potential, I believe.
My wife and I were at a school fair last weekend, and I saw exactly what Tim was saying. As you would expect, there were a plethora of schools hoping to attract the students that were coming. But what I had never seen before were the education service providers, the tutoring services, the software, and athletic programs, and all sorts of things. They now can access these public funds also, as parents don't just have to use their money for private school tuition. It was exciting to see. I saw this even before we had education savings accounts with charter schools. And we have open public school enrollment in Arizona as well, which is a pretty significant thing. And there was this middle school right near our house, a public school, that had two really high-performing charter schools nearby, basis school and a Great Heart school, and both of them used a core knowledge curriculum. This is not Common Core. This is core knowledge. This is actually knowledge rather than Common Core. And it was so cool to see this banner go up on the local middle school saying, "Core knowledge coming soon." And it was a total market reaction. And I think as we look at reform, it's very, very important not just to look to expanding private sector alternatives, but to allow public schools to respond to competitive pressures by personalizing their offerings. And I think education savings accounts will probably help do that. So starting with Aaron, what do you think the impact of COVID has been with regard to education reform efforts?
Well, it's been profound, but I actually want to go back to something you just said. In addition to other things, I've been a former teacher, and I can just say that in terms of the impact on public education, if you include teachers in that universe, you're going to find that there are teachers everywhere that have an entrepreneurial streak. When I was teaching, you know, I would yearn in my heart to say, well, what if I could just pick a few of my friends that I know are great teachers, and we could go create our own school, and I'd teach Latin, and he'd teach logic, and we'd find our best math teacher, and we'd create a school. And, you know, in 2010, it was kind of a little bit shaky, like, how would you do that? We thought about using technology and Skype technology at the time. So these were dreams that you have when you're young and you're a teacher. And I think ESAs are going to lead to a tremendous infusion of new providers, which is exactly what's needed. So you don't want to just keep to the old current providers, but you're opening up a new universe, and I think it will ultimately benefit teachers. But to the point of COVID, it's obviously been profound, right? So getting back to this point about trust, right? For a long time, and it's still true, parents in general trust their teachers, they trust their schools. Americans are less trustful in general of education, but parents generally think, well, my school's okay. COVID peeled back the curtain on that, right? Parents saw in their own living room a low quality of instruction. They might have been confused as to why their children weren't learning phonics. They just sort of assumed that everyone learned phonics, and they didn't see that happening. Or even other things that get down to values or ideology, right? And it it struck at the core sort of compact, I think, our society thinks it had with public schools and the deference we give them. And so in that sense, it was an earthquake and a, to mix metaphors, a tipping point. I don't think we're ever going back to before COVID. This is one of those things that's permanently changed. And for good or for ill, right? In the case of education choice, I think it's to the good. And it's also sort of exposed the need to make the argument on the ground of parental values. Again, coming back to the idea that parents don't just choose schools because they're academically excellent, although that's important, or other things. They choose them because they support and align with the things that they think are important, faith and family and values. I think for a long time, the movement has been a little bit shy about talking about that. And COVID sort of showed us that we need to.
Tim? Yeah, I think one of the things that COVID revealed was that alternative forms of education can really work for families and for students. I'm a homeschool father. We have four boys. We have homeschooled them almost their entire careers. And we have seen a tremendous influx of new families into the homeschool community as a result of COVID. Many of our homeschool co-ops, our homeschool sports organizations have just ballooned. And you know, when you talk to parents, you hear that you know, there were values being taught in the classroom through Zoom that they were exposed to that they weren't aware of were going on. They saw the tremendous, you know, what they considered a waste of time and how much more effective they could be through alternative forms of education. And on the flip side, there were families, you know, one of the things about our homeschool experience is that our sports teams play against charter schools. So there were a lot of families who learned that they really love their charter schools and that brick and mortar school experience really works for them. And so they missed the opportunity for in-person learning, even as many of those schools responded better than others to the, you know, online community. So yeah, I think that the thing, and like Aaron said, is we're not going back. Parents have seen that there's something else out there for them and for their students. They're hungry for it, they're hungry for more. So I think that's really gonna continue to spur more educational reform in the future.
Kara, what do you think?
Well, I don't wanna repeat what anyone else said. I mean, I think that it's pretty clear that there's been a traumatic effect from the pandemic. You know, I mean, I think from talking to parents, of course, there was seeing things that maybe they didn't like or agreed with, but also I think just you suddenly had schools closed and kids at home, and if you're trying to work, maybe that just didn't work for you. And so it created a situation where some parents tried things that maybe they wouldn't have otherwise. And I've talked to parents who, you know, the local Catholic school was open, and so they went to Catholic school because they had to have a school open for their child. And some of those parents stayed, and some did it for 1 year to get through the pandemic, and then they went back to what they were doing before. You know, I think it just created this opportunity in a weird way where people tried something different. I know I was not planning on having a pandemic when I was gonna write a book, and I'd just had a baby, my third child, and suddenly the kids' school is closed and there's no childcare. And I couldn't fulfill my professional obligations and also do Zoom school with two kids who were, I think, kindergarten and first grade at the time. And so we ended up homeschooling for a year, and by we, I mean my mom homeschooled my children. She's a retired teacher. And so, you know, we had that experience and would not have otherwise, and we didn't remain homeschoolers, but I will say my mom made just a lifelong difference in my children's education, and we are still grateful for that. But I think it did. It just created this situation where, whether you wanted to or not, sometimes you had to try different things, and some of that stuck.
So, Kara, let me start with you on this one. At one time, there was a great deal of cross-ideological support for school reform. The idea of charter schools started with liberals, although you had Milton Friedman on the right arguing for school vouchers. You also had Professor Jack Koons at the University of California at Berkeley School of Law, the godmother of the first two urban school choice programs for liberal Democrats, state legislator Polly Williams in Milwaukee and a city councilwoman, Fannie Lewis in Cleveland. That seems to have dissipated. And school reform, to a large extent, even support for charter schools among many, seems to be a more partisan issue now. Am I right or wrong about that? And if I'm right about it, do you think that there is any potential to get that cross-philosophical alliance going?
Well, you're definitely right about that. I mean, I think charter schools for a long time, I think, had the best sort of bipartisan support, and we really saw that fracture and a backlash to charters during the Trump administration. And there's different reasons for that, but I think, you know, some of it was that Democrats really felt like they couldn't support anything that was being supported by, you know, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos or by President Trump, and so that fractured. And you know, when I was starting my book research in 2017-18, I kind of went looking for a middle ground, and I thought there's surely some middle ground with this. And at that time, it's funny now, but I had a few people tell me, you know, you're going to write about that, isn't it dead? Like, isn't school choice dead? Very inspiring when you're starting a book project. I also had a friend tell me, aren't books dead? So, very inspiring conversations. But, you know, I thought there was some middle ground, because you had cities like Milwaukee that have had choice for a long time, and you still have public schools, and you have a voucher sector, and you have a charter sector. But, you know, today I don't think there is much middle ground. I think the political rhetoric doesn't leave much room for it. I don't think there's much trust on either side. And I think ultimately the people who are very pro-traditional public education really feel like they're being attacked, and that their system is, you know, is going to go away. And so that's a hard thing to find compromise on.
Erin, what's your perspective on that?
So I would agree with you, and I would agree with what Kara said, and I would trace it back as well to sort of a backlash under the Trump administration. I think I'm pessimistic in the short term about such a coalition arising, and I even wonder prudentially if it's smart to seek one, only because if you look at the states where school choice is on the rise, it is in the red states, and just from a purely political science perspective, you actually want it to be as partisan as possible in those states in order to drive the Republican perspective to overcome, let's say, local teachers' unions to vote for school choice. So in a sense, when you get down to the local level, it's probably better for it to be partisan for now in the red states. In the blue states, it's going to be a completely different calculus. I think what we're going to see is continued vacancy signs in California as people with school-aged children move out of these blue states and into red states that have family-friendly policies, right? Putting more and more pressure on the public schools. What happens after that, it's anyone's guess, but I don't have a whole lot of optimism that blue states, outside of maybe a few really forward-looking blue state governors, can turn that around in the immediate future. I do think it'll take a lot of pressure just to compete with the red states.
Well, I don't have a whole lot to add. There's no doubt that the Trump-DeVos backlash was significant. I remember sitting down with Democratic legislatures in states where we'd been working on school choice programs who had previously supported and been strong advocates for school choice tell me that they can no longer advocate for the policies because they cannot be aligned with Trump and DeVos. That happened. But I also saw, even before Trump and DeVos, the dollars that were flowing into Democratic coffers through teacher unions also played a significant role in Democratic opposition to at least private school choice programs. I remember sitting in a Nevada legislator's office where we were pitching the concept of education savings accounts in Nevada, and one of the features of education savings accounts that we were pitching was that students could save those dollars and use them in college as well. And this particular Democratic legislature had been a big proponent of publicly funded scholarships for post-secondary education, and she really liked this concept. She said, "This is brilliant. I love it." we came back 2 weeks later, and she said, oh, I got a letter from the union. This is a voucher. I can't support it. Shut down the conversation. And so it, to some extent, there's always been some partisan politics involved. But I do think it's increased, and it's increasingly polarized, and I find that very sad. I will say that I recently read one book that gave me some hope. The name of the book is Common Ground, and it was a series of letters between a conservative AEI scholar and a liberal education professor here in California. And they were writing to each other during COVID. And they cover a wide range of education reform topics, from charter schools to private school choice programs to education funding to testing. And it was remarkable how, over a series of letters back and forth between two men who were friends, they were able to actually find a fair amount of common ground on all of the issues. Not perfect agreement or perfect alignment, but if you could actually sit down and have reasoned discussions with trusted individuals on the other side of the aisle, I actually do think there's tremendous common ground and places to seek reform. But it's a very difficult time to do that in this current political environment.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that doesn't translate to the political arena, where if you're a Democrat and support school choice, you're going to get primaried. And if, you know, and a lot of baggage comes from either side. One of the first school choice programs was actually in Illinois, of all places. And it was a tuition tax credit for private school students. And I think the reason it succeeded there was that Catholicism overrode partisan differences. And, you know, we're litigating these cases. We're eventually expecting to get up to the US Supreme Court on the Establishment Clause issue. So we're fighting against separation of the concept of separation of church and state. And I go to the governor's news conference, and there's a table with two seats, one for the governor and one for the Bishop of Chicago. And so the governor talks about this program, and then he looks over at the bishop, and I'll never forget his words, because my reaction was, it's over. He said, Bishop, let's go sign a bill. And boy, I'm glad no one got that on tape, because that would have come back in the briefs. What's really depressing is that program that was upheld in the Illinois courts was just repealed. It's one of the first school choice programs to be repealed, and I think that the partisanship spelt its demise, which is really sad. So I'm going to finish up the Q&A with one specific question for each of you, and then turn it over to the audience. Tim, universal empowerment scholarship accounts have drawn criticism from Governor Hobbs in Arizona and others, relating primarily to perceived misspending, perceived cannibalization of support for public schools, and an alleged lack of transparency. Do you think any of the criticisms are valid? Do you think any of the reform proposals are valid? And do you think ESAs can survive efforts to repeal or restrict them?
Yeah, that's a lot in that question.
You have 30 seconds.
I know, right? Let me address the accountability issue first and the transparency issue. The ESA program is honestly one of the most transparent and most accountable programs operated by the state government. So if you're a vendor who wants to offer educational services to students in the ESA program, you first got to be vetted by the Department of Education and placed onto the educational marketplace. So that's where parents go to purchase all of their services that they use with their ESA account. So you've got the pre-approved vendors, you make an expenditure through the marketplace for these services. Those expenses still have to be approved by somebody at the Department of Education before it's actually, you're free and clear to know that you're not gonna have to like reimburse the ESA for some missed expenditure. You can also submit for reimbursement, but those reimbursements have to be approved by somebody at the department, and all of that data is publicly available. So I don't think there's any issue with regard to transparency. All of the purchases are are exactly what the legislature has laid out in the statute as far as what sorts of services and educational options parents have and to choose from on the educational marketplace. I haven't seen any allegations that something that they're spending the money on isn't legal under the program. And it's possible that, you know, over the course of the program, the approved expenditures have actually changed frequently. When the program was first adopted, parents were allowed to purchase computers and other technology items. That actually went away after a little while. There was some feeling that, oh, they shouldn't be buying laptops or other things. Well, then COVID hit, and kids needed laptops to access education. And all of a sudden, the legislature said, oh, we're going to change the law. You know, we're going to allow parents to purchase technology with their ESA accounts. So I have no problem with the legislature revisiting the approved expenditures as they're watching how parents are spending the money and they're seeing the financial accountability. If they don't believe it's being used appropriately, if the legislature wants to change that, I think that, you know, is within the legislature's purview. When I saw, there was a recent big, you know, scandalous piece. We were all waiting to see what the Arizona Republic or ABC 15 had uncovered, and it was a big nothing burger. Like, there was nothing on there that I was even remotely offended about that parents were purchasing with ESAs. To the extent that there were fraudulent purchases, there's mechanisms for prosecuting parents or seeking reimbursement of the ESAs, but those were like a fraction of the amount. And even those allegedly fraudulent purchases, I thought were kind of on the bubble. So no, I don't think those are valid. Now, are ESAs going to survive in Arizona? Are they, is the program going to be scaled back? I don't know. I think there's tremendous support from the parents who are participating in the program, but I think there's about 80,000 right now, give or take a few thousand, one way or the other. There's a tremendous new constituency for the ESA program, namely these new vendors who are entering the marketplace as well. So I think there's tremendous opportunity for those parents to exert political pressure on the legislature to keep the program operating, ensure that it doesn't go away. But right now, the Arizona legislature is like a one vote majority in both houses in terms of pro-school choice majorities. It's razor thin. I think they're going to hold the line this year, but it's an election year, and I don't know what the state legislature is going to look like a year from now and what that might entail for the program. So I do think it's safe this year. I don't think we'll see anything. I think the Republicans are going to really hold the line, but I don't know what the future holds. And it, just in terms of, you know, the notion that this is like draining the state budget, I mean, that's one of the most absurd arguments, because the students in those programs actually get 90% of what the state would spend in the public schools. But if they go to public schools, the state is still spending that money. They're spending more money to educate those students in public school. So the money's going to be spent one way or the other. It's just, is it going to be spent at the direction of the parent, or is it going to be spent, you know, by the public school officials who receive those funds in the public school where the students are now forced to return to? So that's the question.
So I'm not allowed to make a commercial endorsement, but Kara's book is really cool. And one of the reasons it's really cool, I did not realize it had been published, but someone came up to me and said, Clint, you're in this new book about education, and there's a chapter with your name in it. And sure enough, over the course of the school choice litigation that culminated in the Zelman decision, there were 16 lawsuits, and almost all of them I was up against the chief lawyer of the National Education Association. So we got to know each other so well that I could not only give his arguments, I could give his arguments in his voice. Oh, is it? Is it? Did I say that?
It's in the book. I put that in the book. But
there's a chapter called Bullock versus Chan, and you know, the book is just that chapter alone. Is
just read that chapter.
But Kara, your subtitle of the book suggests that conservatives won the battle over education policy. What do you mean by that, and what strategies do you think were especially effective in that regard?
So, I was telling you before this, but the title of the book gets me some won't say hate mail, but some responses from either side. I think, you know, conservatives are generally happy to have won, but don't necessarily like the main title of the book, which is The Death of Public School. And then I get a number of emails from liberals saying they have not won yet. It is not over. It's not past tense. How dare you? But you know, in doing the research, I just, one of the things that I thought was so striking, you know, is that I trace 70 years, primarily 70 years of school choice history in the book from the 1950s to roughly present day. And one of the things that I just thought was so striking in looking at that history was how far the movement has gone from the beginning. And looking at some of the earliest proposals and how sort of modest they were, and the dollar figures were rather low and fairly limited. I mean, when Milwaukee's program started as sort of the first modern program, it was like a few hundred kids. It was limited in the amount of kids that could be taken essentially from the school district. You know, and there were just all these parameters around it. And I thought that's such a tremendous shift, where this year when I was doing an event in Florida, I stopped and visited a micro school and talked to the director of this school. And, you know, micro schools can be different things, but what her program was essentially 80% of the kids were homeschoolers, and they would come in and take classes, you know, maybe once or twice a week, and then maybe the kids would go travel somewhere and they'd say, we'll see you in the spring for geometry or what, you know. It's such a remarkably different way of providing education, and that is publicly paid for. So you're hard pressed to say it's not public education. And so just that shift to me was so tremendous that I really felt like, and with the legal history, you know, from Zelman up until Carson versus May, I just felt like that's such a change that I think you could, regardless of enrollment numbers, say, you know, that something has been won, you know, something has changed that I don't think can be easily undone. You know, and strategy-wise, you know, I think some of it is just that programs began small, you know. They were generally described as experiments, and a lot of the focus was on targeted populations, you know, so it was low-income students or students with disabilities. And so I think you could make a case, you know, and advocates did make a case, that these are children who, you know, need options, perhaps more than other children. And so that was kind of where it started in a way, you know, as far as being successful. And I think then over time those things have grown and the income levels have increased, and, you know, and now we've reached this place where we're actually talking about what Milton Friedman talked about in the 50s, which is universal choice. He was talking about vouchers, but the idea that it's good for everyone. And that's a, you know, a fairly remarkable change over time.
So one of the greatest experiences of litigating this was getting to know Milton Friedman and his wife, Rose. And Milton was not a fan of this start small and focus on low-income kids, to put it mildly. Every time I saw him, he said, Clint, you know, I really love what you're doing, but I wish you wouldn't just focus on low-income kids. He said, programs for poor people are poor programs. And one time when he said this, Rose said, Milton, do you realize that every time you see Clint, you tell him that? And he said, clearly he's not getting it, so I repeat it every time. But in any event, you're absolutely right. I do think that starting small and focusing on the kids who needed it the most was critical. Aaron, last question from me for you. Texas is a bastion of free enterprise. It's one of the reddest states in the country, and it's accomplished a lot with regard to charter schools, but it is a lagging indicator when it comes to private school choice, despite tremendous political capital that has been invested in it. Why do you think that that's the case, and do you think that there's a good prospect that it will change soon?
There's a lot to tackle there. So let's start with
one thought, which is that this issue has not been prosecuted on the moral framework that it is currently being prosecuted on now. So I would just simply say to those who may be pessimistic about Texas or doubt its prospects, we haven't started the fight yet. This is the first time that we've seen statewide political capital using the term parent empowerment. They've fully bought into the framework that this is about parents and their choices. In the past, this has been prosecuted on grounds of academic quality, competition, helping poor kids. All of those things are wonderful, and we don't dispute them. It has not been prosecuted on these grounds, and I would just say that where we're seeing progress, and we are seeing progress on this, it's because the rhetorical framework has shifted profoundly. I will note that Texas Republicans support school choice 88% to 12%. We know this because it was on the ballot for the primary in 2022.
Wow.
So that's powerful. There are individual state representatives who know how their voters voted on this. Statewide, this includes all Texans, the support for private school choice is 54%. And that's consistent. We see that in poll after poll, and it really doesn't matter on the way the question is phrased, even if it's a very biased phrasing of the question, Texans are generally very supportive of private school choice. So I would say this is a matter of time. We've seen tremendous political will and a lot of investment this time around, and I think that that is not gonna let up, because we know that Texas is the whole ball game, and the other side does too. The other side knows that if Texas goes in the direction of universal school choice, which is the moral high ground, it's kind of the end. It really will put it in the past tense, Kara. I mean, it really will be the end of a whole regime, because Texas has got 5.5 million public school kids, and we're growing, unlike other states.
Want to mention any in particular? With that, I would like to turn the questions over to you, and I know the microphones will be coming around, so why don't you deliver a microphone, and that will be my way of choosing who to ask the question. And please do identify yourself. We'd love to get to know who you are.
Yes, Garrett Latham from the Fresno chapter. A few weeks ago, maybe a little bit longer, John Oliver on HBO had a little segment about homeschool and child abuse, and couched it as a way for people who abuse children to get out of investigations or just do it under the guise of homeschooling. So you talked about how people, geez, I guess 40 years ago now, were being jailed for it. What is the state's interest, or at least what was it back then, about making homeschooling a crime? And I suppose the next question is, was it really something else?
One thing I'd like to say, and I'm gonna pull up some of these news clips, that argument about homeschooling being a way to cover up child abuse, it goes back to the 80s, okay? It's right here in this news clipping, okay? The arguments against homeschooling and school choice are ancient. One of the reasons you can predict what the other side is going to argue is because they're always going to argue the same things. Just a little hint there. Makes it pretty easy, actually. As long as we have, in the United States, a framework of parental rights, there will always be risks. We know this, right? And the state does have an interest in protecting children from abuse. That doesn't mean the state has a right to prevent parents from homeschooling their children. Those are two separate considerations. So I just simply say that arguments about quality, about parents not teaching their kids to read, again, going back to the first quote I read about parents abusing, these are not new arguments. Of course, some parents do abuse their children, and this is a tragedy, and those things are crimes, and they should be prosecuted. And nobody will argue that. So I probably turn it over to you, Tim, since you work in that space.
Yeah, I work in that space now. So I looked into those issues. I looked into the specific cases that were cited. And in every single one of them, there were numerous reports to the state's child welfare agencies, and they had gone into the home and somehow failed to discover the abuse that ultimately led to the child deaths in each one of those cases. There was one of them where the parents were actually moving from state to state after each investigation to flee those public, those government officials. And somehow they still failed to recognize that these children were in danger because they had been reported in their state, the next state. And one of them was actually right here in California, which was the most highly regulated state for homeschooling. You can't homeschool in California without being associated with an umbrella organization that comes in and inspects your home, that looks at your curriculum, and that approves these things. So I really don't think it's a valid argument against homeschooling. But I do agree that the state has an interest in investigating claims of child abuse and going in and protecting those children from abusive parents. But I don't think the problem is homeschooling. I think the problem is a failure in the breakdown of the child welfare system and the proper investigative procedures that were employed to ferret out the abuse that was reported to those state agencies.
Just to add from my own personal perspective, I had mentioned that I did these cases pro bono. The reason that I did them pro bono is that the board at Mountain States Legal Foundation turned down my proposal to litigate them through Mountain States. And the reason was they saw these people as crazy people, child abusers, and basically fomenting the death of public education. Now, Mountain States or any of the conservative litigation organizations would love to litigate cases like this without a second thought. So there's really been a sea change in perceptions of this, especially, you know, homeschooling used to be and was, when I represented these people, associated with non-mainstream religions primarily. And this was a way of manifesting antipathy toward toward those religions, among other things. But now it has become incredibly mainstream, so hopefully we will not see that specter arise. While at the same time, having child safety agencies make sure that what's going on is education and not abuse. Next question I see. There we go.
Probably more of a comment than a question.
And you, and please.
Jamie Sheridan, I'm from Golden, Colorado.
Hi, Jamie.
The school district of Golden, Colorado is the Jefferson County Public Schools, over 80,000 at one time students. Probably top 20 in the country in terms of enrollment. It's in declining enrollment right now. I had the fortune of being able to serve on a nonprofit board of an art center. And as you can imagine, on the board of a nonprofit art center, myself and one other gentleman were the conservatives, and most other people were fairly liberal, nice people, but our director said, this past year, oh, we're going in a new direction. We're going to have more services for homeschooled children here. And there were gasps from other board members, like, well, why are you doing that? And thinking about who the typical homeschool children are. And he said, oh, no, you don't understand. These students, these parents, they're liberal. They're keeping their children at home. And the board members were like, why? And he said, because they're scared for their children. They want to protect them. Now, I'm from Colorado, so you know that Columbine was there and there's other things. And that's primarily what they're trying to protect them, or at least that's what's on the surface. But these parents really are trying to protect their children. So, as a very learned person, I wasn't very familiar with ESAs. So I commend you for coming here and educating at least me, if not many others today. I challenge you to keep educating, because I think in states like Colorado, there's a lot of parents that will take on the school, not the school boards, they'll take on the teachers union once they understand what's available for their children. So thank you very much.
Isn't it important?
comments or?
I would echo, you know, Austin's, Austin ISD, which I live in Austin, I'll go ahead and cop to it. The enrollment decline has been going on for well over a decade now, and I think you guys know the demographic of Austin. That's not a bunch of conservative wackos withdrawing their kids from the public schools. That's Austinites sending their kids to charter schools or moving out of the district. So I think you're onto something, and the people that I know who are more on the left, you know, when they understand what an ESA is, of course they support it. Problem is the politics of the Democratic Party right now are pretty much locking those voices out.
Hello, Andrew Quino from Orange County, California, with the Pacific Legal Foundation. There's been a lot of discussion today about the elevated, angry tone of public discourse and a lot of issues, and it's certainly familiar in the discourse surrounding our public schools. We've all seen the viral videos of people and parents yelling at their school boards. You know, Moms for Liberty has a lot of these videos. But it does seem like a lot of that angry rhetoric and that attention has brought and raised awareness about school issues and school reform issues that other issues haven't gotten attention for. And maybe it seems like that's the case because the people who are angry about it are a little more connected, personally connected to these issues versus, you know, let's say election denial or election fraud. Do you think, notwithstanding the damage to the civic decorum or civic dignity of this type of rhetoric, do you think it has helped the school reform movement or has it hurt it?
I think it's helped. I'll go ahead and say it. I think it's very unpopular among the great and the good to look down at parents who are screaming at board members and making a fuss. But they're doing it for a reason. Something bad happened, and they have no other choice. So one of the ways that we framed this conversation in Texas is on four pillars. One of them is we start with transparency. Parents deserve to know what's going on in their school and their child's education. The second is quality, and that means quality as the parent defines it, whether that's the ideological content or they need to learn phonics. The third is if those things aren't happening, they deserve respect from the school board, from the administrators, from everyone they interact with. These are unassailable things. These are 90-10 kinds of propositions. You just don't see anybody disagreeing with those three. And then when you get to the respect part and you say, now what happens if you don't get respect? What happens if you bring these to the school board and you scream and you cry and you're arrested, which has happened in many cases? What happens next? You don't have a choice. In any other case, you'd have a choice. And so it's kind of walking folks through that framework, and you get to the idea of choice. And I think we have been very shy to make that case because these are culture war issues and we don't want to touch the culture war. But that's what motivates parents, and that's what they see in their students' lives. And we shouldn't be afraid of the fact that we're going to have to be talking about those things.
Well, when I hear about the UC and I hear you know, there's confrontation going on between a parent and the school board, I always look to Neil McCluskey at the Cato Institute's public school battle map. The Cato Institute tracks all of these instances across the country, and it's remarkable how many battles are occurring. But what I love about Neil is that he says school choice is the answer for resolving so many of these issues. The schools are engaged in the culture war. They're going to find the solution on one side of the aisle or the other. But what school choice does is it allows us to be tolerant of one another's views and have your kid educated the way you want your child to be educated and allow me to educate my child the way I believe I should educate my child. And so to the extent that we're able to point to choice as the solution, the way we can decrease a lot of this public rhetoric that is increasingly hostile, slinging mud at one another, I really appreciate being able to point to school choice as a way to be tolerant of one another.
By the way, those of you who are earning CLE credits today, the Federalist Society has modified the form. And if you look at the fine print, it says, I certify that I attended these sessions and I promise to run for the school board. next question on this side.
Jason Connie from the San Francisco chapter, and it's like you introduced my question. I'm a former school board member, two-term. Not something I necessarily advise.
And San Francisco.
In the Bay Area.
Yeah.
But this is also similar, except on the last question, the role of school boards. I really appreciated the conversation earlier about how the public's perception of what is public education is changing. But if you broaden that definition, particularly in the Arizona context, to different institutions that are only regulated by the state, that goes around school boards. So is that a good thing or a bad thing? Should school board institutions be changed? I'd be curious to hear.
Well, I'll take the lead on that. So I recently co-authored a book called Unshackled, and the subtitle is Freeing America's K-12 Education System. And by the way, my co-author, Kate Hardiman Rhodes, was just offered a clerkship with Justice Barrett. So in the second edition of the book, she's going to be the lead author, since she's more professionally accomplished. But one of the arguments that we make in terms of unshackling public schools is that we should abolish school districts. And that, of course, is a pretty radical idea. But it emanates from the thought that if we were starting a K-12 system today from scratch, would we organize them along lines that in many instances were created 150 years ago, that are the sources of funding inequities and other types of inequities that are subject to capture by special interest organizations, and this is the big thing, that add a breathtaking amount of bureaucracy and cost that never reaches the classroom. And so, and this runs counter to, you know, the center-right instinct of local control, but we think it stops to a level too short of school-based management. So, interestingly, I think this idea might resonate with some on the left. And guess what? If you're trying to do education reform in California, good luck doing it as Republicans, right? And I think that some of these ideas may have the potential for convergence because sincere liberal education reformers have no use for school districts. And so conversations like that, I think that it may be the case that in some instances, and I think this was true with vouchers versus education savings accounts, our problem has not been that we've been too radical, but rather that we haven't been radical enough. And I think thinking things through, and I so appreciate your question because I wasn't gonna mention that, but hopefully it's some food for thought about next gen education.
I was gonna say, I mean, I'm not an advocate, so you know, I can't say if it's a good idea or not. But I, you know, I do kind of, I think that one of the reasons that choice has in some ways been an appealing or powerful concept is because of what he's talking about, just that, you know, when you look at school district boundaries, they are often carved out to create privilege. And if you've been on a school board, then I'm sure you know that. You know, and one of the examples I use, having lived in New York City, is that just above New York, there's Bronxville, where I don't think you can get a house for less than $1 million. And if you look up the, you know, the course offerings at the high school, I mean, every AP class that you could possibly want for your child. And if you move 2 miles over, you're in Yonkers. And you know, it's higher poverty and it's more students of color and the course offerings are not the same. You know, and so just by that boundary line. And so I think that's one of the things that people who are worried about losing traditional public education also have to grapple with. And on the school board question, you know, as an education journalist, I've gone to so many school board meetings where it was like me and two other people, and it's the same two people, you know? And so it's been interesting to watch all of the engagement, some of it prettier than others, you know? But I also, I do wonder if some of that, though politically useful for choice in the short term, is not damaging in the long term, you know? And I think we're still kind of watching that play out. But yeah, it's one of the questions I get sometimes is how can you be involved in the issue? I'm like, go to a school board meeting. Like, so often nobody's there and they're voting on very important things, so.
Well, I want to echo what Clint said, that notion of performing the thought experiment about how would we design public education if we could build it from the ground up and really erase from our minds the current model of education. I can't imagine we would come up with the current model. I mean, there's no other area of our lives where we dictate where you shop based on the geography. You're not assigned a specific grocery store that you have to shop at. You're not assigned a particular doctor based on your zip code. This is the only area of our life where we say, if you live in this particular house, you must attend this particular school. And then we actually, by law, say, if you don't, as a parent, send them to that school, unless you've got a school choice program, you can actually be prosecuted for violating our compulsory education laws. It's utterly insane. And so I think it's a tremendously helpful exercise to think about those things. And if it's a way, if it's a door to bring in folks on the other side of the aisle, I think that would be a tremendous benefit to them. I mean, way too often we hear stories of kids who are locked out of a public school that's literally, you know, just down the street from them because of an arbitrary line that's been drawn. And too often those lines themselves, if you dig in historically, were drawn based on racial animus and racial discrimination in the first place, an old practice called redlining, and it's despicable, and I think it's just a terrific idea, so thank you for raising that point, and thank you for the question.
Yeah, and thank you for your service.
Yes.
Your past service.
In Texas, there are school districts that can actually charge tuition for students that transfer to them. Fun fact. And there's this widespread idea that public schools have to take everybody. You've probably heard that a million times, right? It's just not true. And once you can point out how much public schools do discriminate against students on all kinds of different bases, I think you can really appeal to the intellectually honest folks on the other side, and there are plenty of them. Again, that's separate, I think, from the political question of how to move the special interests that currently call the shots.
And time for one more question. You got it.
Christopher Bakus, Sacramento, and it's relevant to my mini anecdote and my question, a member of St. Ignatius Parish in Sacramento. The room will be delighted to learn that our governor, as he was acting contrary to all the teachings of the Holy Roman Church, was then attempting to enroll his child at St. Ignatius Parish School. Question one, hypocrisy of leadership. Many of my fellow Democrats do send their children to Catholic schools in particular. Second question.
While dining in a French laundry. Oh, I didn't see that.
Second question. I'm wondering if, at least in California, if the curriculum has not become so hostile to faith-based organizations and religions, particularly the Catholic Church, whether or not anybody has given thought to creating a right to alternative education because of the violation of the First Amendment. So those are my questions. And you didn't hear from me that Gavin tried to enroll his child.
Well, I mean, yes, people have thought of that as a claim, and I wouldn't be surprised if you start seeing lawsuits of that sort filed in the future, the not too distant future. I don't have any specific knowledge. I mean, honestly, I don't. I've been out of the Institute for Justice for a while. I haven't talked to folks in the movement, but you know, that sort of conversation certainly has occurred in the past and could be the basis for litigation in the future. I will say one thing though about if you enjoy the hypocrisy being exposed, you really do need to follow what my friend Corey DeAngelis on Twitter. He is tremendously quick at ferreting out folks who oppose school choice as a capacity in the state legislature or the city council, and exposing the fact that they send their kids to private schools. So he's a fun one to watch.
One thing I'd like to point out is that that argument is a very old argument. In fact, it was made in, again, 1985 by Representative Daniel Webster, the author of the homeschool legislation. Here's what he told the Orlando Sentinel. He said that, it was, they're framing this, the Republican representative said parents who object to the lack of religious influence in public schools should, quote, have a basic constitutional right to teach their children at home. So I think that kind of lays bare exactly what you're talking about. There, it's not ideologically neutral. It is fully ideological, contentful, and more should be made of that.
Well, with that, I want to thank the audience for fantastic questions, and especially thank my co-panelists for outstanding contributions, and the Federalist Society for just being the best. Thank you very much.